Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Comrades and friends, this is Siegfried speaking for Back in the USSR, and welcome to our first show of 2021. Now, you may be asking, how is this the first show of the new year, given that CFRU has been broadcasting episodes for the past 2 weeks, since January 1st? But this is the first new show of 2021. It frankly hurts to admit that I haven't recorded a new episode for the past 4 weeks, but like so many people, I was demoralized in this time period. I was scared. I was uncertain. I was sleep deprived. I didn't know what to say or where to begin, especially when the new year rang in as it did, with increasing COVID fatalities and new lockdowns, and there was no end in sight. You know, I mean, I had a real hard time trying to figure out what to say or what to do a show on, or what to start. Like, yeah, where to even begin? I mean, the best case scenario for Canada right now, the best projection is that a vaccine will reach the general public by the fall of this year. And that's going to be too late for a whole lot of people who will get sick and die because of the policies put in place by the federal and provincial governments. instead of mass COVID testing and quarantining virus outbreaks at their source, the government of Ontario has put profit first and people second, sending people back to work and school without the virus being contained and under control, and often without adequate safety measures. Cargill, a major meatpacking plant in Guelph, remains open, despite being the source of a large-scale COVID outbreak that has claimed the lives of at least two people and sickened many more. It's the same story all over the country, with social assistance drying up and workers compelled to put themselves in harm's way for the sake of a paycheck. And it should come as no surprise that infections are increasing and that Doug Ford's stay-at-home orders, which he just announced, amount to window dressing and nothing more. And similarly, Quebec's measure of instituting a dusk-to-dawn curfew has proven to be equally ineffective at halting the spread of the virus, yet very effective at encouraging police harassment. And the international situation is also pretty damn bleak. I mean, let's be frank about that. Whether it's fascists storming the U.S. Capitol, you know, fascists in their thousands storming the U.S. Capitol with the open collaboration of law enforcement, you know, captured on video, open collaboration with law enforcement, or the outgoing Trump administration's, ratcheting up tensions with China, Russia, and Iran with aggressive military buildups and provocative statements. You know, like, things aren't looking good. Nor does Joe Biden appear to offer any solutions. You know, he's basically a lame duck. He hasn't even started yet, and he's already a lame duck in his statements and policies and all this, like, lukewarm stuff he puts out. The American empire is in a dangerous mood, and there's really no telling what it will do next. The only guarantee is that it will be violent, as empires are. Instead of putting people first and going all out to halt the pandemic that has, you know, claimed more than 400,000 lives in the U.S. by this point, you know, a death that hasn't been seen since the Spanish flu, basically. You know, it's a death count that's higher than the U.S. death toll in both world wars. Congress has instead passed a record-breaking military budget and literally handed, like, trillions of dollars to big business. And at the same time, it has been bickering over whether the public should get a one-time check of $600 or $2,000 per person in federal relief, you know, which amounts to next to nothing when rent and other expenses are factored in. You know, nor is debt forgiveness being considered. And of course, they all want to blame China for the catastrophic and systemic problems that the pandemic has exposed for all the world to see. American capitalism, as well as global capitalism, is in a deep, deep crisis. But this fact only highlights and confirms the very real successes that socialist societies, socialist countries around the world, including socialist countries suffering under sanctions and blockades, have had in combating the pandemic over the past year. In the case of China, they achieved much more than bringing COVID-19 under control. They actually broke the bonds of poverty itself, successfully overcoming one of the cruelest legacies of colonialism. China has achieved its goal of eliminating extreme poverty, even in Xinjiang and Tibet, you know, these more remote regions of the country. It also landed the Chang'e 5 spacecraft on the moon, dispatched the Tianwen 1 spacecraft to Mars, and launched its own GPS-style satellite network, amongst other things. You know, I think there was like 39, space launches from China in 2020, like way more than any other country. And I could also get into China's recent advances in quantum computing, nuclear fusion, high-speed rail, electric vehicles, and semiconductors, but I think you get the picture. China's total renewable energy capacity reached 840 gigawatts in 2020. You know, 3.5 times that of the U.S. And that includes 240 gigawatts of solar power. And it's worth recalling the hostile and utterly racist attitude that the Western media displayed towards China from the beginning of the pandemic 1 year ago. The COVID-19 virus was portrayed as the death knell for China's socialist, quote-unquote, authoritarian state, offering final proof of its failure and illegitimacy. The pundits were positively crowing. You know, we're talking like, you know, Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, all the usual, The Economist, all the usual ones, you know, the National Post in Canada, you know, all the mainstream newspapers. The pundits were positively crowing that the end was near for the People's Republic of China and for the Chinese Communist Party. You know, the Wall Street Journal even proclaimed that China is the real sick man of Asia. You know, direct quote there. Thus resurrecting a racist stereotype that was common at the beginning of the 20th century when, you know, European powers and Japan were carving up China into spheres of influences. And nor did any of the commentators seriously consider that the virus might threaten their own countries. It was a Chinese virus. You know, as Trump famously said, as Donald Trump famously said, infamously said. You know, they were all smug in their own delusions of superiority. And they just, you know, they sat back to watch the presumed death throes of another evil empire. You know, like, you know, they called the USSR an evil empire. You know, they call China an evil empire now. You know, they sit back, they think it's in its death throes. Just like the Soviet Union was in its death throes. They sit back to watch it basically fall apart. Like, they want it to fall apart. They think it's falling apart. And they're just, you know, being spectators, cheering it on. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, at the beginning of last year, I mean, he was declaring the United States was the best prepared country in the world for the pandemic. And that no additional measures were needed, you know, like spring break and all the holidays and all that stuff, like all went as planned last February. No precautions were taken. No lockdowns were introduced until April. You know, 3 months after the pandemic was... you know, came on the scene in China, you know, no warnings were heeded. And of course, 1 year later, the world is a very different place. China didn't collapse. Not only did it successfully contain the pandemic in the winter months of 2020, not only was it the only major economy to see growth that year, it also fulfilled its goal of eliminating extreme poverty by the end of December. You know, that was projected in the five-year plan, you know, that was, you know, that ended at the end of last year. And they successfully did that even though it was a pandemic year. You know, they still successfully eliminated extreme poverty in China. Even in the most remote and isolated regions of the country, people now have adequate shelter, income, healthcare, and nutrition. It's a huge achievement. Especially seeing where China was at the time of the Chinese Revolution in 1949 when, like, you know, the average life expectancy was, you know, barely 35 years. You know, and now they've eliminated extreme poverty entirely. And there was also an extraordinary coming together in the face of the pandemic. You know, Chinese doctors and healthcare workers were given all the tools they needed and put in extraordinary life-saving efforts. Often in new hospitals, purpose-built and rapidly constructed to deal with the influx of COVID patients, you know, in a nationwide coordinated campaign, you know, united effort, you know, made solidarity with all the regions of the country. Huge labs were built that were capable of conducting thousands of COVID tests per day, along with mobile labs that were able to test whole neighborhoods at a time. Communist Party committees ensured that people were fed and that their needs were met, even in cities under heavy quarantine, sometimes delivering food and necessities via drone. I mean, everyone followed the science and did their part. And the response was unified, proactive, and effective. You know, like China really came together around this. And Wuhan, the first city to experience the outbreak, came out of lockdown after 76 days. While most other affected cities were able to safely reopen safely reopen after 2 to 3 weeks. You know, they had contained the virus. You know, they had dealt with it. But China's antivirus measures didn't stop at China's borders. They extended worldwide. China was the number one supplier of personal protective equipment to the whole world in 2020 and dramatically expanded production capacity to meet rising demand, you know, everywhere. China supplied no less than 40 billion masks to the U.S. alone. You know, protective masks, like, in the course of the year, along with 12,000 ventilators, which is not something that the mainstream media likes to talk about. You know, the mainstream media is constantly demonizing China and treating it like the enemy. China was also able to deliver desperately needed medical supplies to countries devastated by U.S. sanctions, like Venezuela and Iran, much to the empire's anger. And China also has the greatest number of COVID vaccines that have reached phase 3 trials and will likely become the world's leading vaccine supplier in 2021. In fact, it's noteworthy that Chinese vaccines, the Sinovac vaccine in particular, have undergone far more rigorous and widespread testing than the candidates put forward by Western corporations like Pfizer and Moderna. You know, tested in multiple countries, under like extreme conditions in some cases, and they've just, you know, been rigorously tested far more than say Pfizer and Moderna, which seem to have been rolled out last November largely due to political pressure, you know, to get them out before like the election, so Trump would have an election boost or something like that. That seemed to be the case with Pfizer anyway. And you wonder how much testing those things actually went through, and when they claim to have like 90% effectiveness rates and whatnot. Now, China is now pretty much back to normal. Millions of people traveled around the country during the National Day holiday at the beginning of last October. Christmas and New Year's were marked with large-scale parties. Chinese New Year 2021, which is coming up in February, will likely be just as busy as it was in 2019 when I was still over there teaching in Ningbo. The United States, by contrast, has been tearing itself apart. You know, it's the complete opposite of China. You know, it's been tearing itself apart. You know, as have other Western countries, but none so spectacularly as this supposedly indispensable nation, right? Which the U.S., you know, humbly likes to refer to itself as. I mean, just look at how things began last year. I mean, warnings were ignored. 3 months of precious time was wasted. The healthcare system in the United States, such as it even existed, rapidly broke down. And all efforts were made to reopen the economy as fast as possible after the initial lockdowns. Even as the death count mounted, when it was obvious the virus was still totally out of control, and attempts to educate the public about the disease were frankly half-assed at best. You know, like, the result of these anti-human policies is a country that has over 1,000 COVID deaths per million among its citizens, compared to just 3 per million in China. You know, 1,000 deaths per million. Those are basically like wartime figures there. You know, and consider that when California first imposed a lockdown in March 2020, and I think it was one of the first states to do so, the state ordered all non-essential businesses to remain closed. Like, it was a pretty complete lockdown. However, when it reimposed the lockdown in December, at the peak of the holiday shopping season, all retail stores were allowed to remain open, even as outdoor parks were closed and COVID deaths were spiking. That's what capitalism looks like. Profit comes first, public health a distant second. And that's the case all over the United States, and frankly, most capitalist countries for that matter. In addition to exposing the tyranny of the profit motive, the pandemic also exposed the tyranny of racism in American society. America is, you know, let's be clear, America is a white supremacist nation that also relies on multi-ethnic and multinational workforce. And that's a contradiction that it tries to literally paper over with a highly flawed and woefully out-of-date constitution and political system that it still promotes as being divinely inspired. You know, laughably promotes as being divinely inspired. Of course, Asian Americans were widely scapegoated for the pandemic and faced a wave of racist violence in which they were yelled at, spat on, and physically assaulted. And university students and professors of a Chinese background faced a virtual inquisition at the hands of academia and the FBI, with some being deported or even railroaded into prison on trumped-up espionage-related charges with no substance. Of course, the killing of George Floyd and numerous other black Americans by racist cops only further confirmed the criminal nature of the American system, you know, built as it is upon like slavery and genocide. And of course, this resulted in mass protests that were met with savage repression by the authorities. And of course, there's been like numerous comparisons between like, you know, when the fascists stormed the Capitol on January 6th, the police response compared to like when Black Lives Matter protesters showed up at the Capitol building, you know, in June of last year. And they were met with a heavy-handed response. National Guard was out. You know, like, there was massive display of force, a major violence by the authorities, major crackdown. And meanwhile, like, these thousands of, like, in many cases, armed fascists managed to get, you know, were basically let in to the Capitol building by the cops. You know, no barriers, no, like, armored vehicles outside, no National Guard, nothing. Right? Total, you know, like, it's just, well, black and white. You know, that's the difference. And, I mean, the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, you know, with these thousands of outright fascists, it's only the latest confirmation that the American Empire has hit a proverbial brick wall and that its many, many, many chickens are coming home to roost. And it's also no wonder that some Chinese social media commentators, including some who have attended university in America, have started referring to the U.S. system and American politics as a black hole that is impervious to change from within and will require immense external pressure if it is to adopt a saner and more humane policy stance. Something to think about there. Similar remarks, of course, could be made about the UK, which had a similar botched response to the pandemic and has lost more than 100,000 people because of it. The only thing that has made things a little more bearable in England is the presence of the NHS, public healthcare system, which, although badly defunded and riddled with cutbacks, you know, over decades now, is still better than anything the Americans have. And you could say the same thing about Canada, although Ontario in particular is looking pretty shabby right now, with its overflowing hospitals and morgues. And all this after enduring decades of budget cuts and downsizing under Tory and Liberal governments alike. You know, same story. Neoliberal policies facilitated this disaster. And that should never be lost sight of. Cutbacks cost lives. Big time. In the case of a pandemic. You know, the real, like, horrific nature, the just inhumanity of neoliberalism is, and all its policies, associated policies, is just coming out of the woodwork now, just being exposed. And the American Empire, not surprisingly, has lashed out amid its suffering over the course of the past year. Illegal sanctions against Iran, Cuba, Syria, and Venezuela have tightened to unheard of levels at the height of the pandemic, and all diplomatic protests have been ignored. You know, there were numerous protests, including from some European countries, that, you know, the U.S. should not do this. I mean, it's horrific. It's monstrous to do this during a pandemic. You know, tightening up the sanctions and, like, you know, cutting off all kinds of like financial channels, you know, anything that's going to like, you know, allow these countries to like import medicines or whatever. To do this in the middle of a pandemic is inhuman. The US just ignored them. The empire wanted to impose as much suffering as it could, you know, cutting off supplies of life-saving medicines to numerous countries, resulting in many, many, many needless deaths and untold suffering. Yet it's also true that none of these sanctioned countries succumbed to this onslaught and all preserved their independence. All of them persevered. Socialist Cuba now has 4 indigenously produced vaccine candidates for COVID-19. Venezuela has developed its own highly effective treatment for the disease, and Iran has been working closely with China and Venezuela alike to develop its own effective response to the pandemic. You know, under extreme conditions, extreme duress. Venezuela and Cuba, both socialist countries, have weathered the storm far better than, you know, and despite being under sanctions, they've weathered the storm far better than neoliberal American client states like Ecuador and Brazil, which have been just devastated by this pandemic. You know, and both Venezuela and Cuba have seen their socialist systems further entrenched and strengthened in the collective effort of fighting the disease while resisting an ever more aggressive American blockade. You know, there's been a real coming together in Cuba and, you know, increasingly Venezuela as well. Even Iran has lost fewer people in this pandemic than either the UK or the US, both of which may ultimately need those Cuban vaccines when corporate giants like Pfizer fail to deliver, as they already have in some cases. So overall, it has been the capitalist heartland of North America and Western Europe that has been exposed for all its lies and deception over the course of 2020. You know, all these places that were seen as the best prepared for a pandemic. Turns out those were all lies. All these areas have been almost like pretty much the worst affected of the entire world. While socialist states, by contrast, you know, China, Venezuela, you know, Cuba, Vietnam, North Korea, socialist states keep advancing. And they give aid to all those countries that seek their assistance. Whereas nature has dealt the capitalist world a blow from which it will probably never recover. As hard as it might be for many people in this part of the world to admit, the evidence is clear. China works. Cuba works. Socialism works. But capitalism doesn't work, and neither do the countries that fanatically embrace it. We really saw the future in how China handled the crisis, you know, putting people before profit. We saw the future in how the Bolivian people took back their country last year from a brutal right-wing coup regime backed by the United States. We saw the future in how tens of millions, hundreds of millions of workers and farmers rose up across India, challenging a neoliberal government dominated by open fascists that had thrown them to the wolves during the pandemic. We saw the future in how countless thousands of people rose up and defied the police across North America, rejecting systemic racism and the efforts of pro-capitalist politicians to silence or co-opt them. Working class and oppressed people were making history around the world in 2020. The world did not stand still in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the same will be true in 2021. The great Rosa Luxemburg, whose assassination at the hands of a right-wing death squad in the streets of Weimar Berlin was memorialized last week, stated that the world is faced with a stark choice between socialism or barbarism. and the death of Patrice Lumumba, a dear comrade who met a similar fate on January 17th, 1961. He also stood for socialism and against barbarism and understood that there was a fundamental choice between the two. And the pandemic has brought this fundamental choice into the limelight and made it inescapable for all of us. Everyone must now ask themselves whether they want to build socialism in 2021 or contribute to barbarism in 2021. There is no middle ground, and we are at a crossroads. One of these two directions has a future. The other does not. Socialists fight for life, while capitalists embrace death. So which side are you on, comrades and friends? Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Allo'nun uhtin çoğlan ey tuksküldür un çirini Oyyin gıhşık şoğan martık muçit un çirini Haytı lecimin boçkuyla muçit bi un çirini Allo'nun uhtuk ıçkır çıxakır hıt Un çirini
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Heard a couple of songs there. First one we heard was Handsome Furs, Serve the People off their album Sound Capital. And then we heard the Chinese-Mongolian band Ajinai from their album Synthesis. That song was called Walk Alone. You know, so a bit of a song, for being under lockdown, I guess. But I've taken many, many walks alone in the last month or so. But what I want to do here is I want to give a little shout out to a project I worked on in the past few years. It's kind of regrettable what happened to it, but I still think this is an amazing interview that me and Clara Sorrenti, formerly of the Communist Current, did with Ian Goodrum, who is an amazing journalist who lives in Beijing and has a pretty great insight into what's been going on in China. So we did this interview with him in 2019, so this is before the pandemic. But everything he talks about is still basically the case in China now. In fact, maybe even more so in terms of their development of electric vehicles and clean energy and all the different things that we talk about. So I'm gonna play about 20 minutes of that to close the show out. So enjoy, comrades and friends, and I'll see you next time. Solidarity.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Communist Current Podcast. I'm your host, Clara Sorrenti, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about the trade war against China, Huawei, Meng Wanzhou, Hong Kong, and the extradition law. Today's episode is special because I'm introducing a comrade I've known for a long time. He was the host of Back in the USSR Rebel Music Radio for 8 years and recently got back from teaching English in China. I'd like to introduce Siegfried. Hey, yeah. Siegfried, what's up?
Hello, Clara. It's good to be on the show. I mean, I've really been looking forward to this for quite some time. And yeah, it is good to be back. I mean, it's been...
Yeah. The last time I talked to you on a program like this was when you interviewed me
right.
for the provincial.
So that
election.
Was a few years ago now.
That was about a year ago.
You know, kind of been taking a bit of a hiatus from radio, obviously teaching English in China for the last 10 months or so. I went there last August. To Ningbo, which is basically in western, eastern China, let's be clear, on the coast. And that's where I stayed for the last 10 months, teaching at a teacher's college there, teaching English. So that's
really
where I was. This is the third time I've done that. I've stayed for a total of 3 years in China since 2013. And I've been in a number of the provinces there. I've taught English in Suzhou, a major city just to the west of Shanghai. I've also taught in Tonglao, one of the major cities in the Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region in northern China. So I've been to some diverse areas. I mean, obviously the guest we're going to have today has been to a lot more than I have. But nonetheless, I do have some experience in this part of the world. So I'm really glad that you've brought me on the show for this. I think it's going to be exciting.
Oh yeah. No, I'm really happy to have you on the show. Cause throughout Canadian news right now, it's just Huawei, China, the trade war. And I think a lot of the people listening today are really interested to hear from the perspectives of people who have recently been to China, mm-hmm. what exactly is going on.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and there's a lot of misconceptions, of course, about China, the whole idea of it basically being a, Orwellian police state and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's really the kind of stereotype that's in a lot of people's heads, and including people on the left. I mean, one of the things which we're going to be talking about tonight, of course, is the situation in Hong Kong. And I remember seeing some anarchist acquaintances of mine really cheering on those protests and stuff and saying this is just classic example of mass mobilization, civil disobedience. This is just so impressive. They were just so amazed by it, blown away by it. And obviously they didn't bother to look any deeper. I mean, it's basically what they're seeing is, you could say the method is the thing which they really are interested in, the tactic. And wherever that manifests in the world and by whomever, they're impressed by it. They don't really look into it and see, okay, who are the actual people behind it? What are the forces behind it? They didn't really bother to look deeper. And plus, they were like citing things like the Globe and Mail and, mainstream
Isn't
media
that interesting?
Articles in Canada, right? Which, of course, are not exactly friendly towards China and generally have, printed very, very pro-Western.
Oh, yeah.
Ideas, which, are very one-sided and just don't really reflect the situation, as we will discuss.
It's kind of interesting to me that, a lot of these leftists know not to trust the mainstream media for certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when Korea comes up, especially the DPRK. Like, I've seen articles saying all citizens have to get Kim Jong-un's haircut. No citizens allowed to get Kim Jong-un's haircut. And the most ridiculous one I've seen today was, until today, was that every citizen had to produce 200 pounds of feces per person per day for the government.
Yeah, basically it's ridiculous stuff, right?
Yeah, and these are the same news outlets that are putting out the things about China, and I just question, can we trust it?
Well, the things you can't.
Yeah.
Obviously there is an agenda here, which which we will definitely talk about in this podcast. This is really going to be one of the major themes. But why is this happening here and now? Why is there so much attention to what is going on in China and the various situations that are developing in places like Hong Kong? And why is there this escalating trade war all of a sudden? Why did this come along now? Why here? Why now?
No, absolutely.
And why did Canada decide to do Donald Trump's bidding in arresting one of the top executive officers of Huawei, right? This is one of the things we're really going to get into in this podcast, because the timing and the context, these things are very, very crucial to understanding this. And of course, all of these things happening at the same time.
Did you happen to see Justin Trudeau recently at the, I think it was the G20 the G20 summit.
Yes.
Yeah, that was funny.
Very, very interesting little moment he had there.
Yeah.
And pretty awkward.
For the people listening who don't know what we're talking about, he sat down next to Xi Jinping of China and Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil, and he avoided making eye contact with Xi. He tried to shake Bolsonaro's hand and was just ignored, and then Bolsonaro shook the hand of the person to the left of him just to not talk to Trudeau.
Right. And of course, I wouldn't want to talk to Bolsonaro either, anyway.
Yeah.
But obviously he did. He wanted Bolsonaro's attention and all that kind of stuff, and wanted to get chummy with him. And I guess he wasn't feeling it that day. your right-wing, homophobic would-be dictator, leader of Brazil, that kind of thing. I mean, Justin Trudeau apparently wants to be his pal. I mean, I don't get that.
He's always been a really contradictory figure. I mean, one minute he's the first prime minister in Canada to march in a pride parade, but he doesn't care. He would hug Jair Bolsonaro.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
He'll be pals with Saudi dictators. He'll sell light armored vehicles to them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. I mean, this is the difference between policy, actual policy, and then you have the public persona. Right. And then, of course, there's a lot of contradictions between those things and, the media image that they want to cultivate. And this is why you have to keep calling them out. Right. Because people see the media image and this is what they believe. But really, what do they actually do?
Right.
Yeah. This is the thing which, of course, you have to look at. And this, of course, also feeds into what we're talking about today.
So, Siegfried, coming back from China, in the Canadian media right now, there's a lot of talk about it. What's it like on the ground in China? What are people thinking?
Well, that's that's kind of a broad question right there. I mean, I've had different experiences everywhere I've gone.
Mm-hmm.
In the different provinces I've been in, I've been in three different provinces in terms of where I've worked. And of course, I spend a lot of time on the ground in those various places. And you can't really China is a very diverse country.
Right.
First of all. It has many non-Chinese ethnic minorities as well. I was in the first place I went to in China was Inner Mongolia, which of course has a very sizable Mongolian population. In fact, that is the area of China where definitely Mongolian is a official language. All government business is done in both Mongolian and in Mandarin Chinese.
Right.
And you see, like, all the signs are all bilingual. You know, everything is kind of arranged like that. Education system is all bilingual. It's very much organized in terms of giving self-determination to the Mongolian culture and the Mongolian population in that part of China. And of course, like in the other areas I've been in, of course, like in Suzhou and in Ningbo, these are, of course, like, you know, you also have like, those are multilingual cities. Because all these areas of China have their own regional languages,
right?
Which are non-Mandarin. In fact, a good percentage, I mean, I don't know, maybe our guests can fill us in on this, the percentage of the Chinese population that actually is bilingual or even trilingual is much, much, much higher than what it is in Canada.
Oh, I could definitely, you know, believe that.
Like, a lot of these people who I have taught, you know, would have learned like a regional language from their home province and Mandarin before they learned any English. Right. And of course, they all learn like English in school. Like, that's why I'm there. I'm kind of part of that. They've kind of pushed this whole ever since reform and opening up began. I guess in the 1980s, it started up and then, but more, much more heavily in the 1990s, like English as the international language of business has been really kind of part of the school system. So that's kind of like why people like me are there. But all the cities that I've been to are different. You know, mm-hmm. The population has been very, very diverse. The kind of opinions you get are very diverse. You cannot really pin down. I mean, the whole idea that somehow the population of China is just a bunch of automatons and they just do whatever this all-powerful government tells them to do is just nonsense. I mean, like, there's definitely a lot of patriotism. Like, you know, people really believe in China.
Oh, yeah.
They've seen China rise, you know, more than 700 million people lifted out of poverty. You know, it just seems things are getting better. You know, there's a better future for their kids, you know, as time goes on. You know, they're really confident their future generations will have it even better than they do and have more opportunities. And their country really has arrived after, like, you know, suffering from semi-colonialism and underdevelopment and all of that sort of thing, and really kind of being, you know, besieged for a long time. You know, by the United States, by the British Empire, you know, by various imperialist forces,
and
know,
the Japanese.
By the Japanese. Yeah, and like all these different powers, like keeping them down. And now, of course, that is not the case. So they understand that. They really have they understand this, the importance, I would say, of self-determination. If there's one thing I could say about China is they understand the importance of that way more than people in Canada do, unless you're talking about Indigenous people. And whenever I talk about Canada to them, and I talk about Canadian history, I'm always very, very, what's central to that is I do talk about colonialism in Canada, settler colonialism in Canada. Mm-hmm. I talk about Indigenous people and their struggles to assert their self-determination on what is their land. And that is, and they can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Whenever I talk about that, whenever I talk about Louis Riel, for example, I mean, they get it. They understand what he was up against because they were up against something similar in China, you know, like where they're fighting for their self-determination. They understand what that means. I would say a lot more than a lot of people in this part of the world. And that's something which, where, you know, you have to really, really, struggle, I would say, like, if you want to get, say, high school students here to really grasp what it means to fight for liberation.
Right.
You know, to really what, like, you know, when you're under colonization and to fight for liberation, to fight for like self-determination in your own country, to determine your own affairs, you know, whether that's political, economic, or what have you, that's really not a conversation that's really happening in this part of the world. But over there, they all get it. I mean, it's not something you really have to stress too much. And I think that's something that really has stood out to me in all the places I've been. All the places I've been, I've talked about this sort of thing because I think it's my responsibility. You know, coming in from another country, from Canada, especially, you know, a settler colonial society like Canada. But yeah, like that's the main thing which really stands out for me every time I go there. But of course, you know, China, to reiterate, is such a diverse country, such a massive country. I mean, if you think, like, you know, 1.4 billion people, some are all going to be like carbon copies of each other. I mean, you have a very orientalist, very colonial attitude, I would say, And I think that's one of the important reasons why people should go to China, like from this part of the world. If you're coming from like a settler colonial right. context like Canada, you know, if you're a white person like me and you go to a place like China, you actually experience it, you live there mm-hmm. and see what's actually going on, and you get past yeah. the propaganda, you actually are on the ground and interacting with people and experiencing what it's like. It's you will see, like, this is a very complex place. This is a very dynamic place. And all the stereotypes that you mm-hmm. have ultimately will have to be thrown to the side. You know, they cannot stand up when you actually have that experience. So I think that's kind of right. like the takeaway that I got, you know, in a nutshell. I mean, I could just go on for hours about this, but we obviously have limited time here.
I spent a week in Beijing myself. I think my biggest takeaway was the immenseness of it all. Like, we're used to a country with like 30 million something people. And then I go to one city that has it the same, if not more, people.
Right.
And that's...
like in one place.
Yeah. That's not something I'm used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, of course, I wasn't used to that either.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the closest you had to that? Toronto?
Yeah, that's nothing.
Yeah, like, that's peanuts compared to if you go to, like, a place like Shanghai or even Ningbo, for that matter. I mean, even a place like Ningbo, which a lot of, and Suzhou, like, these two cities, which a lot of people in Canada probably have never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are bigger than Toronto. Like, both of these places are bigger.
So before we introduce our guests, I'd just like to give a shout out to all of our supporters on Patreon. Paul Hoffman, Vivian Jane Horn, Osran Vukrobrat, Jeff Carr, The CYM, Robert JL, Justin Stewart, Jennifer Moxon, James Phillips, Ruslan Gaynutinov, Mohammed Sarakaya, Thomas Wall, Jason, Shane Marches, John T, Jeff Tomlinson, Matthew Fain, Ashley Anaya, Kevin Sanders, BDEF, Jerry Goldberg, Juliana Cohen, Basil Baldwin. To see what benefits you can get from supporting us on Patreon, go to patreon.com/thecommiestcurrent. Now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest for the episode, editor and columnist for the China Daily, Ian Goodrum.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Ian. How's it going?
It's going well. We're operating on a 12-hour time difference, right? So it's morning for me and evening for you guys, but we managed to make it work. Yeah. I was curious, actually, before we get into the topics we were going to be discussing. So, Siegfried, you said you were in Ningbo, yeah?
That's right.
So my experience with some of the quote-unquote small towns in China, which tend to have, you know, the small cities, quote-unquote small cities in China, which still tend to have millions of people, was that even in what are considered kind of small cities, there was still a pretty vibrant public services. Like I'm thinking in particular about mass transit. Was that the situation there?
I would say yeah. I mean, basically, they were building a new subway line very close to where I lived, my apartment, yep. And definitely they're in the process of expanding that. You could see the kind of expansion of the transportation grid. So, I mean, that was really, and the same thing was going on in Suzhou. I mean, I'm sure they were working on, I believe they just opened a third subway line and they were working on a fourth. So you can see, even just talk about subways, and obviously that's not the only, transportation, which is really being expanded, but that's maybe the most noticeable. Yeah.
No, it's not the only one, but it's my favorite. So I always want to know. Yeah,
true, right?
That was something that I noticed. I forget which city. I did last year I did a journal tour with other media outlets on the Yangtze River Economic Belt. It went to like 12 provinces over the course of three and a half weeks. And that was something I noticed. I forget. It's all kind of a blur because we were only in each place for one or two days at a time. But I do remember being in some of the, you know, what the Chinese would consider small cities and seeing like, oh, a subway station. clearly there's I mean, like a mass public culture, too. The other thing that this generates, obviously. And it was just such a striking thing because living in Beijing, which is, you know, what's referred to as a first tier city, by the based on the kind of administrative levels of China, because cities can be administrated on the county level, prefectural level, or provincial level. And the provincial level cities, Beijing, Tianjin, Chongqing, Shanghai, are the municipalities. Those are the highest level. So those are generally referred to as the first tier. So you would expect kind of a robust set of public services. And that's certainly the case in Beijing, Shanghai, and Chongqing, and Tianjin. But to me, it's really striking that these kinds of this kind of infrastructure is being built everywhere, not just in the major cities. Certainly my experience in the U.S. has been that you only, if you're lucky, in certain parts of the U.S. only, you might have a functional transit system in some of the bigger cities, but not all. Los Angeles being the most obvious example. So that was just something I was curious about from your experiences.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I live in a city of about 350,000 people called London, Ontario. And we don't even have bus rapid transit here. Like, we don't have subways.
Yeah. Right.
And we don't even have buses that go past midnight. So if you don't have a car and you're working a night job, you have to carpool or Uber.
Yeah, there's just no concern for people working regular jobs, right? It's only if you only have transit operating during the day, then you're only catering to white collar workers who work during the day. So there's clear priorities at work. And I will say one knock I do have in Beijing specifically, most like Shanghai, the trains run late.